Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast lifting the language barrier to show you the world through its media.
Radio Tehran.
Мы не вторгались на территорию Украины.
Western countries are not the international community. That era has finished.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Jo Fidgen. Welcome to this bonus episode in the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm one of the presenters of the BBC's Lives Less Ordinary podcast, extraordinary personal stories from around the world. We'll bring you an episode of Lives Less Ordinary here when we can, but to hear every episode, search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you find your BBC podcasts.
I saw a group of boys playing football. They had a really raggedy football and rock set up as goals. They reminded me a little bit of home. They were playing barefoot. They were arguing about goals. And it was the way I grew up playing with my brothers and cousins in the streets of Amman. I had a football in my trunk. I got out of my car with the ball. They saw it. They ran to me. They wanted the ball. I wanted to play. We haggled, and they reluctantly let me into their game. They gave me the short kid and the chubby one. But I still had to prove that I could play. The first 5 or 10 minutes, they weren't passing to me. But then after a couple of goals, I had to earn their respect. You know, I think like any athlete, you kind of have to earn it on the pitch, right?
That impromptu football match in a side street in Atlanta, Georgia, was a game changer for Luma and those boys. They call it the beautiful game. Believe me, this is a beautiful story. Welcome to Lives Less Ordinary. I'm Jo Fidgen. It's a story of two halves, naturally. The first half takes place in Amman, in Jordan, which was the childhood home of Luma Mufle. It's a surname that carries a lot of weight and a lot of expectation. Luma's father was a very wealthy steel magnate. His connections extended into the most powerful families in the country. But her mother's family had a very different background. They were refugees from Syria. And her maternal grandmother made sure that Luma was never going to forget it.
It's in my blood. You know, like my grandmother fled with my mom. And I think for my grandmother, it was really important for her to remind us of where we came from. Like not just Syria, but like of having to leave your home. And she took me to my first refugee camp when I was around 7 or 8, Palestinian refugee camp on the outskirts of Amman. And, you know, when she told me she was taking me there, I didn't understand why. Like, we usually went to the market or went for ice cream or went on drives outside of the city. But she did that often. Like, she would go to the refugee camps and visit with women there and listen and have tea. And so she took me there. And when we got it there, like, I was scared. Like, it was a level of poverty I had not seen before. People were living in tents. The place was dirty. It was really crowded. Kids' clothes were falling apart, and here I was in a crisp polo shirt and clean pants and bright clean sneakers. And my grandmother said, you know, go play with the kids in the camp. And I was like, no, they're not like me. I'm not going to go. They're poor. They're dirty. And she knelt down before me and said, go play and don't come back until you've done that. My grandmother's a very loving person, but when she speaks firmly to you, you listen. And so I did, and I ended up playing with a group of kids, and I loved it. And so, you know, when we got back, yeah, I was like telling her the kids, most of them were better than me in football, which is, you know, hard for me to admit sometimes. And that we had fun, and we had all this stuff in common. And then I remember when we were walking out, you know, I said, haram. It's Arabic word, and it has several meanings, but I was using the meaning of poor them, like that they live like this, that they don't have any opportunities. And my grandmother said, no, haram on us, taking different meaning of the word, meaning that we are sinning to allow this to happen on our watch. And that just stuck with me. I didn't think, you know, about 20 years from that moment, it would come back full circle.
Her grandmother was very clear with Luma, don't show charity to these refugees. to make yourself feel better. Do something meaningful and keep asking yourself, what else can I be doing to help? What next? But Luma was just a child with football on the brain.
I think for me, it was an outlet. It was a physical outlet. Like, it gives you a high, you know, when you're playing. And I think growing up in the Middle East, maybe there's like a little bit of rebellion, like girls didn't do it. And so I wanted to do it. I wanted to play like my brothers and my cousins. Like, why do they get to do it and I can't? And then part of it is like, I'm extremely competitive. And so I played hard. Like, I would play against cousins that were 4 and 5 years older than me because I wanted to get better. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. I loved just getting better and being able to kick the ball through their feet and run around them. And, you know, I wanted to prove that girls and women are equal, or if not better.
Were those values that you encountered in your family home?
In some ways, I did. Like, my dad signed me up for Little League baseball when I was 7. That was unheard of. But he loved baseball. He loved the league the American Embassy was running. So I ended up playing baseball, basketball, and football year-round in that league. And every now and then I hear, well, your brothers can do it. You can't do it. But push comes to shove, they would always be like, okay, you can do it.
In the 1980s, the American Embassy's league wasn't open to just anyone. That Muffle name opened doors, and Luma's parents would push open any doors for her. They absolutely doted on their boisterous daughter, and she doted on them, although her grandmother was special.
I think I was closer to my grandmother than my parents, but, you know, the Arab family, it's like this big, not necessarily a tree, I'd call it like a bicycle, and you're all spokes on a bicycle. I had incredible aunts and uncles and cousins and good parents.
There were things you couldn't talk to them about. One big thing in particular, which was your sexuality, when you realised that you were attracted to other girls, to women.
Yeah.
I mean, was there a moment when you thought, oh, this is me?
I think it was like very early on. I remember I was in elementary school and I was playing with a group of boys. Most of my friends were boys at the time. And there's this girl named Isabella. Everyone had a crush on her. She's beautiful, straight brown hair from Indonesia. And my friends, Justin and Michael, and I were talking. And they wanted me to go ask her who she liked. And Justin was like, ask her if she likes me or Michael. And I was like, well, what about me? And I said that in my head, knowing even then that I was like, wait, I also like her. And I want to know, out of the three of us, who she likes. But I had enough messages at that age to know that I could not factor that in. And I remember I went up to her and asked, like, who do you like, you know, Justin or Michael? And first she said, Michael, because he's good at sports. And then she's like, no, Justin, because he's nicer. And I just kept waiting. It's like, well, what about me? Like, I'm good at sports. I'm also really nice. Like, you know, and I think that was my first heartbreak, realizing that that would never happen. And she ended up picking Justin. So, yeah.
But you say you'd had lots of messages. You knew this wasn't something you could say. What kind of messages were there in the air, as it were?
I mean, there was no example. Like, there was no one, right? You didn't see it anywhere in media, nowhere on television or magazines. There wasn't a word for it. Like, I felt that God had made a mistake on me.
So who was your first role model? Where did you get the idea and the word from?
I was in 10th grade. I had gone to the library to read right before practice, and I saw Newsweek magazine with Martina Navratilova, not on the front cover, but part of the story on the cover.
This was the champion tennis player.
Yep.
Famously gay and open about it.
Yes. And, you know, we'd gotten Newsweek and Time magazine at the house, but this cover was different. The State Department got the American version. And so I was like curious, like, what's so different about it? And I love tennis. And so I started reading it. And I remember there was a line in there, you know, like, out of all her accomplishments, maybe the one biggest one is that she lived her life as an out homosexual. And I was like, what? And then married to her wife. And it just blew my mind. And I found myself sobbing in the library because I was like, wait, there's someone like me who is alive and married to a woman and is a successful athlete. And, you know, that seeing that magazine came after a really dark time for me. I had attempted suicide the year before. And here was like, oh, wait, there is hope outside of the region. There is a way to be. And I don't know if I would be here today if I hadn't seen that magazine.
You think you wouldn't have been able to carry on living?
Yep.
Yeah. Would you have faced physical threats from other people if you had been openly gay in Jordan?
I mean, I think either I would have taken my life or someone would have taken it. I mean, we still have honor killings in Jordan, so it would have been one or the other.
Luma knew that she would never be able to have a low-profile life in Jordan as a muffle, and she set her heart on going to college in America. So she talked to her parents about it. She persuaded them to let her apply for a prestigious all-women's college, Smith. She'd had a great education. She was a fantastic athlete. She got in, and what a change of scene.
I saw women being themselves, embracing completely who they were. I saw actual people, not just, you know, celebrities who were out and in relationships. And in some ways, like, no one knew who I was. No one knew who my family was. And so they didn't care, right? Like, I was just like everyone else. And I felt I could breathe easier. Like, I didn't have to lie about who I was. And I got to date, which was really fun.
The college years flew by, and Luma realised that she was soon going to have to return to Jordan, where she feared she would have to go back to hiding her sexuality. She knew that if she applied for asylum in America, that would mean giving up her Jordanian passport. She did it, but with a very heavy heart. The hearing took place 2 days after her graduation.
I remember going to the college mailbox, and I got this envelope, and I opened it up. I was sitting on the pavement, and it says, "You have been recommended for approval." You know, I think that moment was one of the happiest and one of the saddest in my life because of what it meant. That, you know, I'd gained my freedom, but I'd lost my home and my family. A few weeks after that, I knew I had to tell my parents, and I called them. I was at friends in Michigan, one of my close friends, and I tried to explain to them what was happening. And there isn't a word for gay. Like, my friend heard me. She'd be like, yeah, you speak in Arabic, and then you said, I'm gay. And then you repeated that several times. And I think because they couldn't accept it, didn't understand what was going on.
When you say they couldn't accept it, what do you mean?
Their initial reaction was that maybe I was brainwashed, that someone had convinced me I was something that I was not. And then they tried to get me back home, tried to bring me back to Jordan.
How?
FBI started looking for me.
They asked the FBI to look for you?
My family was very politically connected, and they called in every favor.
How do you dodge the FBI?
On a Greyhound bus. And so I got on a Greyhound bus, paid cash, traveled from city to city, slept outside a few nights, and then ended up in Highlands, North Carolina, where a friend of mine, her aunt, owned a restaurant there. And so I hid there for a while and then connected with my uncle, who was in the United States looking for me, to tell him, like, if this continued, I was going to go public.
It worked. Luma earned some money washing dishes at the restaurant and just stayed under the radar while her family called off the FBI. But they also cut Luma out of their lives. They disowned her and stopped all communication. So she had her freedom to build a new life for herself in America, but she was going to have to do it alone. The first step was to get a new job, which she did, coaching a girls' football team in Atlanta, Georgia.
It was at the local YMCA. The Y was looking for volunteer coaches. It's something I'd always done. played and coached in Jordan. And so I thought it would be great for me to be doing something that I loved that would give me a sense of home. And so I started coaching this group of girls, and they were under 12 team, and I took them through their U14 years.
In fact, she took them all the way to the state championships. Luma was a great coach, but all was not well. She was really finding it hard settling into this new life that had cost her such a lot. And she was hungry for a connection with home.
I was on my way back from a Middle Eastern grocery store. I was going to find authentic pita bread and hummus, and missed my turn to head back home. And I had to U-turn into this apartment complex. And I saw a group of boys playing football. They had a really raggedy football and rock set up as goals. They reminded me a little bit of home. They were playing barefoot. They were arguing about goals. And it was the way I grew up playing with my brothers and cousins in the streets of Amman. I had a football in my trunk. I'd been coaching club soccer during that time. And so I got out of my car with the ball. They saw it. They ran to me. They wanted the ball. I wanted to play. We haggled, and they reluctantly let me into their game. They gave me the short kid and the chubby one. But we had
on your team.
On my team. But we had the time of our lives. Like, we just played street soccer. It was so much fun.
Were they surprised when they saw how well you could play?
They were, because I was a woman. And they assumed at first look that I was an American, like born in America, raised in America. But they realized I was not, by the way I pronounced their names. A number of the boys were from Afghanistan and Sudan and Liberia. The boys from Afghanistan and Liberia had Arabic names, and I pronounced it correctly. And they just kind of looked at me. And I said, you know, I was born in Jordan. And they knew where that was. I didn't have to explain where that was for them, which was refreshing. But I still had to prove that I could play. The first 5 or 10 minutes, they weren't passing to me. But then after a couple of goals, I had earned the respect. You know, I think like any athlete, you kind of have to earn it on the pitch, right? And so we played, and I found myself starting to make excuses to leave work early so I could play with them. And we eventually formed our first team.
What language did you all speak?
Soccer, football.
Right.
Right. I mean, that was the thing. That was the universal language. So we all had to communicate in English because there's so many languages on the team. And everybody knew football. Everybody had played it back in their birth countries. And it was something that they associated as a positive thing, despite having to live in refugee camps or flee war or see atrocities that kids should never have to see. Football was comforting and something we all loved.
It turned out all the boys were refugees. Living in a city called Clarkston, which is about 20 minutes drive from Luma's home in Atlanta. And the reason she'd been food shopping in their neighbourhood is that it's one of the most international spots in Georgia. In the 90s, it was decided that Clarkston would be a good place to house refugees. It had good transport links, it had enough housing, not least because its former residents were moving further out. And meeting those boys and playing football with them took Luma right back to that visit as a little girl to a refugee camp in Amman with her grandmother. And she connected with them. Only now she knew, as they knew, what it's like to leave your home and start again. So she was happy to give in to their desire to form a competitive team and to be their coach. And they called themselves the Fugees, and it became a refuge for all of them.
I had some players that were former child soldiers. I had players whose fathers were executed by the Taliban. I had a player, he was trying out for goalkeeper, and I went to put the gloves on his hands, and he had part of his finger missing. And he saw me react, and I was just like, what happened? And he's like,
Kh. As in, like, with a cutting motion?
Yep. It had gotten chopped off.
But on the field, you say mostly it was joy. It was, this
yes.
was their release. You talked earlier about needing an outlet in Jordan. This was their mm-hmm. outlet.
This was their outlet. This was their sanctuary. This is where they could just escape from everything that was going on and just be kids and play.
Were they talented or were they just enthusiastic?
They were extremely talented, and they're also very enthusiastic. They're incredibly good with footwork, could zip through three different players, had very good field awareness, but did not know how to do a throw-in because you don't play that on the streets, right? You just put the ball down and you kick.
They had a lot to learn, throw-ins, goal kicks, the offside rule, and they had a lot of equipment to source. One of Luma's players was nicknamed One Shoe because of this one spotless boot that he would bring to practice with him. That first season, in fact, instead of shin pads, they stuck cardboard inside their socks.
We didn't have uniforms our first season, so we went and bought white T-shirts and wrote the numbers down. And sometimes I miss those days because I think that's what made us. You know, it was like we didn't really have anything, but football's a great equalizer. You don't need the fancy stuff. Fancy uniforms not going to make you a better team. You know, the latest messy cleats are not going to make you run any faster or shoot any better. And so, yeah, we made do. It was fun.
How was it the first day that you went off to a match together with this sort of homemade kit and a group of boys who've never played like this before?
It was a little rough, I think, because I hadn't prepared them. I assumed that they would know how to line up and do the equipment check when the referee is calling their names, and the referees didn't know how to pronounce their names, and so that caused tension. But they all showed up on time. Some of them were super tired because they didn't sleep all night because they're like playing their first game. It was just refreshing in some ways to see the excitement, but then the kind of work I had to do on the back end to get them prepared to make sure that they had their equipment, that, you know, if a referee mispronounced their name, how to correct it. Even spelling out the night before, this is what you eat. This is when you go to bed. This is when you get your kit ready to make sure that you are not frazzled in the morning trying to get it ready. So some of the life skills that I never had to do as a coach before, I had to spell that out. There's also something really unique to the refugee experience in the United States, that when refugees flee, sometimes they don't have their paperwork. So they're given a fake birthday. And so a lot of kids had January 1st as the birthday. Hmm. And the referee thought we were cheating. He's like, 8 out of your 12 players have January 1st birthdays, and the rest either had Christmas Day or July 4th or April 15th, tax day. Those were the days that were picked. Right. And then at one point, like one of the kids, when the ref was like, what's your birthday? And the kid looks at me, he's like, my real birthday or my fake birthday? I'm like, oh gosh. And we'd have to explain to the referees what that meant. And then we had to do the team building, right? And part of it is there was like political dynamics coming in. Like we had kids from warring factions on the team. I said, if you want to win, we got to put some of this stuff behind us. Like, it's about the team. And so one thing I did with them is I asked all of them to go get a stick. And I said, okay, there's 11 players on a pitch. And I said, so here's one stick. So I have one great player. And I snapped the stick. I said, I broke that player. And then I said, give me another stick. And so then two sticks. You can still break it. Up until 7, you can still break it, maybe with your knee, right? But by the time you get 11, I couldn't break it. And no one else on the team could. And I said, this means every single one of you is important. Every single one of you has to show up. Every single one of you has to play your best. And if one of you ends up getting kicked off the pitch or doesn't show up, or two of you, our team is breakable. And I think that's always resonated with the kids. Like several of my players, you know, from 10, 15 years ago, they're like, remember when you told us about the sticks?
Yeah, it's a great image. And did it make a difference? Did they start getting the results on the pitch?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They lost a couple more matches that season, then went undefeated.
If you're feeling gripped by this episode and would like to hear more incredible life stories from around the world, don't forget at the end of this one to search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you found this podcast.
Water used as a weapon of war.
In none of these villages there was any piped clean water for people.
A nation in the grip of criminal gangs.
How bad does it have to get before the international community reacts?
A country showing signs of fracture.
Right now with Sudan, things are really quite dark. The nation is divided. The mistrust runs so deep.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service is back for a new series. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hallo, hier sind Julia und Chris vom Podcast Drinnies. Wir machen nicht nur einen Comedy-Podcast, sondern gehen auch leidenschaftlich gerne nicht zu Stoßzeiten in den Supermarkt. Ehrlich gesagt bleibe ich am liebsten ganz zu Hause und ziehe nur eine Hose an, wenn es klingelt. Wenn es euch auch so geht, dann ist HelloFresh genau das Richtige für euch. Der Kochbox-Lieferservice bringt euch frische, abwechslungsreiche Gerichte direkt vor die Haustür, die ihr im Handumdrehen selbst zubereiten könnt.
Und mit dem Code LECKER24 könnt ihr jetzt richtig sparen. In Deutschland bis zu 120 Euro, in Österreich bis zu 130 Euro und in der Schweiz bis zu 140 Franken. Also Code LECKER24 eingeben und sparen.
PS, der panierte Portobello-Pilz mit Sweet Chili Ketchup ist sehr gut.
From the BBC World Service, I'm Jo Fidgen with the story of Luma Mufle and her team of extraordinary young football players. Luma was strict off the pitch as well as on, so she would get them to sign up to an agreement. They would be well behaved, they would go to school, they would get good grades. You can imagine the parents loved it.
I always use some form of contract when I coach any team, that we all agree to these set of rules and it's all like transparent, right? And so one of it is like, in order to play, you had to pass. And so the kids would turn in their report cards.
Had to pass their school work.
Their school work, yep.
And what happened if they failed their classes?
They would not be allowed to play in the games. So they could still practice, but they can't play in the games till those grades went up.
Did that motivate them?
It did. And they ended up helping each other and supporting each other, because if one of your best players is not playing because they're failing a class, it is the responsibility of the entire team to support them. And so they'd start making sure they all went to school. They all lived in these apartment complexes that were very densely populated, but it allowed them to be around each other. So, hey, like, I'll have kids say, hey, you were absent yesterday, I'm going to make sure you go to school because your grades need to get up. And that's what you want. You want them taking care of each other, not the coach, like, double-checking on everyone.
There was such a feel-good vibe around the team that their siblings soon wanted to join in. And you can bet their parents were keen on it too, because the kids were so much better behaved and doing better at school. So Luma ended up creating teams for different age groups. Something was building.
Part of it is their parents were trusting me with their kids, you know, minimum of 3 hours during the week and weekends as well. And so I would go and meet with parents or drop by and get invited to dinner. Most of the kids from my original teams had single moms, and so got to know them, how to support them.
Was that because the children's fathers had stayed home, or?
For a few, the fathers had been separated, and for a number of them, their fathers were killed.
When did you realize, do you think, that the Fugees were not a team so much as a family, of which you were the head?
Yeah, it was like by default, right? It was at the end of the first season. It was exhausting, right? I ended up stepping into these situations that I didn't think I had to. Everything from going to school to going to ER visits to making sure the parents were employed. I was exhausted. And so, you know, I gathered my team and said, you know, I'm going to go on vacation for a while, for about a week. I'm going to go visit my best friend up in Massachusetts. And I don't want you to call me, because they would call all the time. And I said, it's just for 1 week. You know, if you call me, I'm going to charge you 10 cents a phone call. And I thought it was funny. No one laughed. Everybody just kind of was like sad. And I was dropping off the kids, and one kid usually runs out, goes right to his apartment the minute I pull up. So I pull up and there's no movement. I look over and he's crying. And I was like, what's wrong? And he said, you're leaving and you're never coming back. What's going to happen to the Fugees family now? That was the first time it was called Fugees family. Before that, we were just the Fugees. Again, I tried to explain to him what a vacation was, where I would be, and he was not convinced. And so I said, you know, I never go anywhere without my watch. I'm going to give you my watch, and when I come back, I'm going to come get it from you. And that seemed to reassure him a little bit, and so I gave him my watch. It was a Swatch, you know, so it wasn't digital. And so I went on vacation, and he called me that next day, and he's like, Coach, what time is it? And I thought he was being playful, right? Like, he's just trying to tease me. And I said, I don't know. I don't have my watch. And he said, I can't tell time on your watch. So he couldn't tell time on a watch with hands. So he ended up calling every day and asked me what time it was. And I think he was the one doing the checking and telling everyone else. The minute I landed, my phone blew up because they all knew exactly the time I was landing. And I just felt, yeah, it was a family.
The success of the Fugees gave Luma and her Jordanian family something safe to talk about after a long and difficult silence. And gradually, contact was resumed.
They're like, so you left Jordan to coach soccer, coach football? And I was like, no. Like, I know in your head you think this, so I left. I told you exactly why I left. I mean, I ended up going from being a millionaire's daughter to washing dishes, right? And so they could not grasp, like, why I would give up even the lifestyle I had.
But Luma was in her element and about to get in even deeper. It began with a conversation with one of her best players.
Very early on, you know, we'd do practice and then the kids would ask for help with their homework. And initially I was dismissive. I was like, go get your parents or siblings to help, not realizing that their parents were illiterate in English. And so I started helping some of the kids with their homework, eventually end up being the whole team. And there's this one day where this one kid, Lewis, calls me over. He said, Coach, I have a headache. Can you help me with my homework? I said, sure. He's a quiet kid, really good, could articulate himself in English better than some of his peers. He's originally from Sudan, been in the country 3 to 4 years at the time. And so I read the worksheet and then filled it out for him. Second day, same thing. Coach, I have a headache. Third day, I was like, all right, something's off. And I said, Lewis, I have a headache. Can you read to me? And he said, no, I have a headache. And I was like, no, I have a headache. And so luckily I was more stubborn than he was. And he paused and then, you know, looked up at me and said, Coach, I can't read. And I was floored. My parents sent me to British and American schools because they believed that was the best the world had to offer. And so I naively believed every school in America was like the State Department-run high school I ended up going to in Amman. And I couldn't understand how a kid had been in school for 3 to 4 years and couldn't read. And his report card said he had A's and B's. And so I did what any coach would have done. I started a school for him.
Wait a minute. Yeah. What any coach would have done, I started a school. You make that sound so obvious a decision. It's a massive decision to start a school.
I think what coaches do, what good coaches do, is they take care of every aspect of their player's life. And so if I was a coach and just having them win games, that's about me being a good coach and patting myself on the back. After they're done playing for me, what are their options? What are their choices?
So Luma came up with a plan for the child who'd been pretending he had a headache to hide the fact he couldn't read.
I initially tried to see if there are other schools that could take him, and there weren't any. And sending him to a private school, I couldn't afford that. It was actually cheaper to hire one teacher, get 6 kids. We got a donated church basement, and that's how we started. And then grew from that, and eventually had a school for 100 kids. And then we were asked to replicate, so to open other locations because of the data of the growth that our students showed compared to others in the country.
The schools are built around football and Luma's conviction that sport and the creative arts can help heal trauma. So the day begins with yoga or martial arts. It ends with soccer, at least 90 minutes of physical activity every day and creative arts most days. Everything is tailored for the needs of children who may have suffered a great deal and who may be struggling to get to grips with a strange new life and a strange new language. It's a complete wraparound approach that she takes, but one little detail, just to give you a sense of how Luma tries to instill a calm atmosphere in this school. So instead of ringing a bell to mark the end of lessons, you'll hear music. Also, how pupils are selected for the school is a little bit different. So one of the assessments takes place on the football pitch, although it is not about seeing how good their skills are.
We're checking to see which kid shows up every single day after, you know, a very tough workout. Which kid tries to get along with others, doesn't put each other down. I mean, which one shows up, right? Like, because we're asking them to push, right? We're not looking for the best athlete, but are you going to show up and then give your best? Because that's what we're going to ask you to do in school. You're going to be so far behind. You have to show up every day and give your best in order to get on grade level with everyone else.
The school's teaching methods are as innovative as Luma's coaching strategy as well, actually. So, for example, the children's first English lessons are based around pop songs.
I had a lot of music in my elementary school. My brothers came into the same elementary school at an older age and weren't exposed to as much. I don't have an accent. They do. And I credit it to the music because you learn how to pronounce. But also, if you're a kid coming in and you're a 13-year-old and you don't know the letters of the alphabet, we're going to start you at the beginning. We're going to build on the fundamentals, the foundational skills, and then we're going to rapidly accelerate you. And so we spend a lot of time on that, teaching kids how to add and multiply. And it's rigorous. It's like, okay, you've reached this. We're going to move up to the next level, then the next level, then the next level. We see their experience as assets, not as a deficit, right? So if you have been forced to leave your country, start anew in a different country, nothing's going to be able to stop you. And the teachers need to know that. They need to say, this kid has done so much. Learning to speak English is easy. And we see kids within 3 years go from being illiterate to being on grade level. And grade level, I'm talking about the 8th or 9th grade at that point when they transition back in.
The move into education was bringing Luma more than good results. It also brought her love. At an educational conference, she met Emily, her future wife. Emily is Jewish, by the way. Luma is Muslim. Luma had been getting on better with her family, and she wrote to them to tell them her news.
I emailed my parents about it, and my older brother ended up calling me the following day. He was angry. He's like, why did you have to do that? I said, well, I'm starting a family. We want to have kids. He's like, you can't have kids. What are you talking about, having kids? Like, and I tried to explain how we could have kids. He's like, couldn't you wait till they were dead? And I was like, my parents are young. Like, what do you mean wait till they're dead? And I said, which part is more offensive, that she's a woman or that she's Jewish? Because I was like, yeah, she's Jewish. We have a lot in common. We don't eat pig. I was trying to make light of the situation. But ultimately, I think it was that she was a woman. That was the big thing they couldn't get past.
Luma was disowned for the second time. After a few months, her mother came round and resumed contact, but she didn't speak to her dad for 7 years, by which time she and Emily were parents themselves.
When Layla, our eldest, was about 4, she asked me if my dad was dead. And I was like, what do you mean, is my dad dead? And she's like, well, we never talk about your dad. We talk to Tete, we talk to Namo and Khalo. Like, she, you know, listen, my sister and my brothers. And she's like, but you don't ever talk to your dad. So is he dead? And I said, no, he's not dead. We just don't talk. And she's like, why don't you talk? And I said, well, he didn't like that I married mommy. And she's like, he doesn't like mommy? How can he not like mommy? Right. And I was like, no, no, that's not it. And Jordan, like, women can't like women, men can't like men. And she said, so he won't talk to you? And I said, no, like, we both don't talk to each other. And she said she wanted to talk to him. I was like, you really want to talk to him? I said, I'll call him right now. And she called my bluff, and she said, yes. And so I picked up the phone and FaceTimed my mom and then asked to speak with my father. And my mom was like, what? Like, what's happening here? And he got on the phone, and I said, you know, Balba, you know, Layla wants to talk to you. And she got on, and she's like beaming, and he's smiling, and she's like, you know, Jeddo, I'm Layla. And he's like, I know. And she's like, I'm 4. And then she told him she likes to swim. And it was just like, it was what was needed. And then since then, we've been talking. And last summer, we all got together in Turkey. It was the first time 26 years worth, the entire family was together. So my siblings, their kids, and all of us and my parents were together, and it was beautiful.
And Emily too?
And Emily, yes. Ah. Yep. Yeah.
What about your Fuji family? Because, I mean, they would have come in many instances from many different parts of the world where homosexuality would not be accepted.
Yeah.
Did they know you were gay?
I think they knew and didn't know at the same time, right? It's like the don't ask, don't tell. But after Emily and I got married, a photo of our wedding was on social media. A number of the kids saw it. The person who runs our after-school program called, and she said, they've seen this picture. I was like, what are they saying? She's like, they're not talking to me about it, but they've seen it. I was like, okay, great. And so I couldn't sleep that night. I was like, what am I going to do? And so I went to school the next day, and my three leaders, my captains, didn't even say good morning. Everybody was just solemn that day. And so I avoided them for a little bit. And then finally I was like, okay, come into my office. We're going to talk. And I said, what's wrong? And they're like, you know what's wrong. And I was like, you're upset because I didn't tell you I got married or that I'm gay. And they didn't say anything. They shook their heads. And I said, well, there's a number of reasons I didn't do that. You know, one is I met most of you when you were 11 or 12. Like, what do I say? Hey, I'm your coach and I'm gay. And I said, and the second is a lot of you come from the same religion and the same culture background that I have come from. And when I told my parents, they disowned me. And the kids did not know that history of mine. And it got really quiet. And one of the kids is like, we're not like your family. We're not like that. And one of them said he was really mad because he was not invited to the wedding. And, you know, two families end up pulling their kids out of school because of it, but the vast majority kept them. And I think it's also exposed Muslim families and kids from, I mean, we have kids from like very conservative Christian families as well, like from Ethiopia and the Congo, and they've just been exposed. And maybe there's a kid there that is struggling with their identity, that they do have a role model and their family is maybe going to be a bit more open than mine was.
What do you think your grandmother would make of what you have done? You know, she took you to the refugee camp. She said to you, don't pity them.
Believe in them.
Don't pity these people. Believe in them.
I think she would be proud. Yeah, I think she'd be proud that it's grown from like a pickup soccer game to now supporting schools around the country that work with refugees and immigrants. But I also think she'd push me to ask what's next. And that's something I go back to whenever we're doing something. Is it to make ourselves feel good or is it for the benefit of our community? And are we setting the highest possible standards? And are we doing for them what we would do for our own children? And so I think she'd ask, what are you going to do next, right?
Do you know what you're doing next?
I think we launched this, it's called Project Taronga, and it's a Senegalese for community, hospitality, and belonging. And it's a way for us to partner with schools around the country to help them implement our school model, which is still based in soccer and the arts, but for them to get students ready and celebrate their identities and teach them about their new homes. I sometimes describe it as a longer, wider welcome mat for those coming into new homes.
Luma's not going to tell you this herself, but she is widely celebrated for her not-for-profit Fuji's Family Inc. She got a standing ovation for her TED Talk and plaudits for her book, Believe in Them, One Woman's Fight for Justice for Refugee Children. Even her dad admits he's proud of her.
You know, my dad has a Google alert on me, so he'll send me, oh, did you know, like, your book is recommended as a best read or something? And I'm like, yeah, that, like, I knew that. Like, I usually know that, for Google knows that. I remember when I was going to give my TED Talk, you know, I called my mom and I said, you know, I'm going to come out for the first time publicly on the stage, you know, and she's like, why do you have to do that? People don't need to know your private life. Like, you know, talk about your work. And I was like, well, it's kind of intertwined. And then she's like, well, what are you going to wear? And I was like, jeans and a collared shirt. And she's like, no, no, don't embarrass me. Do not wear that. And her focus became on what I should be wearing instead.
Did you wear jeans?
I did. I wore jeans and my indoor football shoes. I need to be comfortable in who I was. I'm a coach, so... Yeah.
Luma Muffley, also known as Coach. Thanks for listening to Lives Less Ordinary. This episode was produced by Helen FitzHenry. The editor was Laura Thomas. I'm Jo Fidgen. Remember, normally Lives Less Ordinary won't be in the documentary podcast. If you'd like to hear more episodes with amazing people like the Ghanaian man who cycled across Africa to try to get a place at his dream university, or the woman who discovered that her mother was a Vietnamese rock and roll star, search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.